again. This is your host, Tertula. You are now listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. Every week, I will be here from 6 to 7 talking about science, both simple and abstract, and reminding you that science is real. And this week, our theme is love. Belated from a failed Valentine's episode, resurrected for your listening pleasure tonight on Splice. First, a quote about love. A discovery is like falling in love and reaching the top of a mountain after a hard climb all in one. An ecstasy not induced by drugs, but by the revelation of a face of nature that no one has seen before. And that often turns out to be the more subtle and wonderful than anyone had ever imagined. That, of course, was about the love of scientific discovery, which is, I hope, is the love you're in the mood for this evening as we explore the psychology, the physiology of love, as well as we have our top 10 interesting animal mating behaviors, physiologies, and anatomies. Also, we have the weekly segments, Science Where You Least Expect It, and my pseudo-philosophical weekly Thoughts to Think, all coming up on radio.dominican.edu. You're listening to Splice. Before we start on our scientific journey, let's take a brief look back at what some of the great philosophers have viewed love as. Plato declared love is a serious mental disease. And we have yet to find a cure. Sorry, Plato. Confucius, however, quoted that to love a thing means wanting it to live. So perhaps scientists really want every single interesting species on this planet to live, and thus they love the Earth and the Moon and the solar systems. Buddha says he who loves 50 people has 50 woes. He who loves no one has no woes, and I think a lot of scientists would go along that those who have 50 scientific research projects have at least 50 woes, if not more. Lao Tzu said being deeply loved by someone gives you strength, while loving someone deeply gives you courage. So that is the idea that love provides a support system for you. Thomas Mann declared, it is love, not reason, that is stronger than death. I'm not sure science would agree that anything is stronger with death, but we shall find out if love is indeed that as we go through our show. Johann von Goethe was a scientist who proposed that there was a chemical basis for love. And then finally, the famous psychologist Carl Jung paraphrased it that the meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed. Hint, hint, chemistry is coming up in Splice as we look at love. But first, one of my favorite science musical songs related to love, Stuck on You by Josh Ritter. We'll be right back on radio.dominican.edu.
Well, there's one thing, Mama, I think you should know. It is not love that makes the flowers grow, but a complex electron transfer process known as photosynthesis when chlorophyll reacts with the light of day. Since you're gone, the light has gone away. There's one more thing I think you'll find. It is not love that makes the stars to shine, but the spontaneous combustion of superheated, supercondensed gases in a process known as fusion, which creates new elements, of which more will be spoken about later. Hopefully. When the time is right, since you're gone, stars will shine so bright.
love this song. It's like, this is a song about explaining to your parents that you're going to be a musician and not a scientist. And I went to school for about 2.5 years to study neuroscience, you know? And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the way to tell my mom, you know? You know, just to show that I could write a love song, you know? And you know, I would be all right writing love songs instead of being a PhD in neuroscience, you know? But I didn't have, like, one goddamn rhyme about neuroscience in this whole song. And that was the first thing that she noticed. So there's a lot of wailing during this part. I sang it to them over the phone. Best way to break anything to your parents. I could have been a mathematician, studied rockets for a living, would have worked out better. But to get more specific, I'd break every law of physics to bring you back to me again. And there's one more thing. I don't think we should forget. It is not love. It makes the best beer, yeah. I'm gonna make this up here as we fly. But age-old process invented by the Egyptians, pilloried by the Romans, sacked by the Greeks, stolen by the Huns. Populated by the Vikings, sacked by the Vikings, populated again by the Vikings. Stolen by the good people at McEwen's from the Vikings. Or the best head, yeah. Since you're gone, it's the only head I'll get. I didn't sing that part to my mom at all. Thought of that later. Now there's one last thing. Thank God. I'll tell you if I can. It is not love, makes a non-stick frying pan, but a top-secret trademark conglomerate of most likely carcinogenic polyurethane compounds spread in a microthin layer over a negatively charged alloy of aluminum, copper, iron, lead, uranium, beryllium, neostrepium, selenium. Estonium, Latvium, Lithuanium. And some other elements too. And since you're gone, I wish I'd stuck to you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Tortula, and for the next 20 minutes, we'll be talking about the psychology of love and the current psychological theories about love, most of which have occurred recently and have semi-little to support them, but they're interesting all the less. So why don't we take a visit to the psychologist chair and talk with Zick Rubin. Zick Rubin is credited with developing the loving and liking scale. This is a scale of attachment between people based off of surveys. He has three different aspects of loving and or liking. First, there's attachment. Attachment is the need to receive care, approval, and physical contact with the other person. these kinds of attachment questions would be, I feel very possessive towards your partner. Or, for example, I feel lost without my partner, or I feel like I am lonely without my partner. The second category is caring. Caring involves valuing the other person's needs and happiness as much as your own. So questions about caring on this survey would be something like, I would do almost anything for your partner. And then the third category from Zick Rubin's Loving and Liking Scale is intimacy. Intimacy refers to the sharing of thoughts, desires, and feelings with the other person. Intimacy questions would involve, I would greatly enjoy being confided in by your partner, or I can tell my partner all my secrets. That is the loving survey. On the other hand, there is the liking survey, which has more to do with a person's actual qualities. So, for example, they might ask you, I think that my partner is usually well-adjusted, or I would highly recommend my partner for a responsible job, or I have great confidence in my partner's good judgment. I was just having both attachment, care, and intimacy from the loving scale, as well as many of the positive qualities from the liking scale, before you take any relationship too seriously. Zick Rubin's loving and liking scales are online. If you look, I will also be posting on the Splice site, which you should check out immediately, because it's fantastic. There's a link to it on radio.dominican.edu, or you can go there directly at spliceupyournight.weebly.com. That's spliceupyournight.weebly.com. I will have Zick Rubin's loving and liking scales. You can see if you are attached, caring, intimate towards your person, and whether you really like them at all. The next interesting psychologist we want to look at is Helene Hatfield, who is credited with determining the difference between passionate love and companionate love. Passionate love was based off of a passionate love survey. Passionate love is defined as a state of intense longing for union with another. Reciprocated love is associated with fulfillment and ecstasy, while unrequited love of passionate love is associated with emptiness, anxiety, and despair. Passionate love is a complex functional whole, including appraisals or appreciations, subjective feelings, expressions, patterned physiological processes, action tendencies, and instrumental behaviors. That is a definition from the Encyclopedia of Human Behavior. In other terms, passionate love is your puppy dog love from middle school mixed with a little bit of sex. Your brain goes haywire at the idea of this person, and we'll talk about it a little later. This passionate love actually represents a very serious chemical pathway that gets reinforced in your head. Companionate love, on the other hand, is the kind of love that you expect in a loving, happy marriage. Companionate love is defined as the affection and tenderness men and women feel for those whom their lives are deeply entwined. Companionate love is a complex functional whole, including appraisals or appreciations, subjective feelings, expressions, paternal physiological processes, action tendencies, and instrumental behaviors. So you'll notice that the last part for passionate love and companionate love are the same. That might give you a hint that love is very important in our biology. In fact, it is one of the few universal behaviors seen in almost every culture that has a word for love in almost every culture, which is impressive because not a lot of that translates as well in human society. Our next person is John Lee. John Lee developed the color wheel of love. He says there are three primary styles of love: Eros, loving an ideal person; ludos, loving as a game, and storge, loving as friendship. So eros would be loving someone you intended to marry or someone you admired or someone you had deep affection for. Ludos would be loving the attention, loving being a flirt, loving being out and about on the town. And storge, loving as friendship, would be love as companionship, love as someone to confide in, and love as someone who shares time with you. Because this is the color wheel of love, you can mix all these three primary flavors of love, and we get three secondary styles as well. These are mania, which is the combination of eros and ludos. To remind you, eros is the loving of an ideal person, and ludos is the loving of the game. So not only do you actually love the person, but you love the effort and the experience of going into a relationship and working in the relationship. And this is defined as mania or obsessive love. The second secondary style is pragma, which is a mixture of ludos and storge. Ludos, once again, is the love as a game, so you really like the experience. And storge is love as a friendship. So not only do you like being in a relationship, and you actually like the person's companionship, but the truth is you probably aren't loving them deeply as the ideal person. So it's more of a realistic and practical type love, like my freshman year college relationship was. And then the third secondary style, agape, which is eros and storge. So eros, once again, is loving the ideal person, someone you actually admire and think is worth loving, for their own personality traits, and storge, which is loving as friendship. And so you have this beautiful combination of not only do you love this person deeply, but you feel confident and happy confiding and spending your time with them. And this is selfless love. So that's John Lee's Color Wheel of Love to mix and match as your situation requires or warrants. Finally, we have our last psychologist, who is Robert Sternberg. Robert Sternberg proposed the romantic triangle, which is balanced on a scale of intimacy, compassion, and commitment. These are the three corners of the triangle. So you have liking at the top, which is intimacy, infatuation at one corner, which is passion, and empty love, which is commitment, sadly enough. So there's also, kind of like John Lee's little color wheel, mixtures of all three of these. So if you mix liking and infatuation, you end up with romantic love, which has both passion and intimacy. If you mix liking and empty love, however, you end up with companionate love, where you have both intimacy and commitment. And finally, if you mix infatuation with empty love, you end up with fatuous love, where you have passion and commitment, but no intimacy, which seems a little sad. And then finally, Robert Sternberg says, not only can you mix any of these two, but you can eventually, fingers crossed, mix all three. And you finally end up with consummate love that has intimacy, passion, and commitment. So in a quick review, we glazed over the major figures in the psychology of love. There was Zick Rubin, who developed the loving and liking scale. The loving scale included three categories, which was attachment, caring, and intimacy. The liking scale included questions like, how would you actually view this person if you were not romantically involved? Were they well-adjusted? Are they responsible? Are they smart? Then we visited Elaine Hatfield, who contributed to the Encyclopedia of Human Behavior. She proposed two kinds of love, passionate love and companionate love. Passionate love is the hot, burning, deep desire, an intense longing sensation. Companionate love, on the other hand, is affection and tenderness. If you're interested, Elaine Hatfield also went on to talk about the relationship between people who have passionate love and companionate love and their childhood. So really, it all goes back to Blame Your Mommy for Elaine Hatfield some of the time. Then we visited John Lee, who proposed the color wheel of love, noting three primary styles: Eros, loving an ideal person; Ludos, loving a game; and Sturge, loving his friendship. And then mixes, which mania of an ideal person and a game, giving obsessive love; pragma, which is mixing love as a game and love as friendship, as realistic and practical, which is no fun, let's admit it. And then agape, which is Eros and storage, which is loving an ideal person and having that amazing sense of friendship, which we all hope for. And finally, we arrived at Robert Sternberg, who proposed a deep, linked three-point triangle of liking, empty love, and infatuation in the corners, and then romantic love between liking and infatuation, fatuous love between infatuation and empty love, and finally companionate love between liking and empty love. And finally, if you manage to perfectly balance liking, infatuation, and empty love, you end up with consummate love, where you are intimate, passionate, and you have the incredible commitment of empty love, and have live happily ever after in a castle somewhere, I assume, if you achieve that. We're going to have a quick musical break on the science of love, and as well as Noah and the Whale's Two Atoms and the Molecule, which are two of my favorite science love songs. And then we'll be right back at the bottom of the hour with the news. You're listening to Spice on radio.dominican.edu. Thank you for joining us. We are talking about love this evening. Remember, science is real.
Strange attraction draws me close to you. It feels like magic when we kiss. But I'm a scientist, I will write the laws of our love, but I won't be using magic. No logic can explain this all, 'cause oh, we're capturing our chemistry, the 5-HT, the wash of oxytocin flooding through us when we touch. And I am trapped by your testosterone, a junkie for the dopamine high you bring. Our physiology is on overload, that's the adrenaline I feel. Blood pressure's rising with vasodilation, and our mating ritual is worthy of a publication. Oh, I'm talking about anatomy of you and me. Your orbicularis oris flex the muscles of your kiss, and I'm attracted to your symmetry, and you like me for my child bearing hips. Under the microscope, our love just couldn't take it. My act of observation destroyed what we created. And as the black hole between us has grown wider, I've left you for a physicist when I saw the size of his Hadron Collider. Oh, I'm pulled in by his gravity, and he loves me. This is no weak attraction, this is pure atomic force. And feel our activation energy, the delta G, the measure of our true
Welcome back. You're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Tertula. You just finished listening to The Science of Love, which is a song by Helen Arney, who's a very funny graduate student over in England and makes lots of these. songs if you are interested. You can also look up my YouTube playlist for each show online. They will be posted on the Splice site. So please check those out. I actually put a fair bit of thought into those. So then the second half of our show, we need to cover the physiology of love. This is the actual hard molecular science behind those feelings you're feeling. And then we will cover my 10 favorite interesting animal matings. But first, we have to cover the news. In world news, police have removed Occupy London from the area around St. Paul's Cathedral. Also, another Italian cruise ship, the Costa Allegra, is having trouble and is adrift in the Indian Ocean. Good luck, Greek sailors. The S&P has downgraded Greek debt yet again. I'm sure that wasn't good news for the EU or the Greek nation. There was a passenger train derailing in Ontario, Canada, killing 3. In U.S. news, what else can we talk about but the Academy Awards, which were on last night, and I have to say I spent way more time watching them and way less time doing homework than I normally would. The big winners were Hugo and The Artist, each receiving 5 each. However, The Artist took the grand prize that evening for Best Picture. Interesting that they are both about silent films. They are both excellent films, and I highly recommend you go see them at the next opportunity. On the snubbed list, Harry Potter and War Horse. Harry Potter nominated for 3, won nothing, making the Harry Potter series end with no Academy Awards under its belt. Sad for an 8-film, incredibly commercially popular series. Billy Crystal hosted the award show again, which was very exciting and very funny, though looking through the newspapers this morning, he has received mixed reviews on his hosting duties. Johnny Depp was nowhere to be found. I don't really think that counts as world news, but it made an impression on me. In the headlines, Sacha Baron Cohen spilled fake Kim Jong-il ashes on Ryan Seacrest. And that's all I have to say about that. In other news besides Hollyweird, we have the Ohio school shooting where 1 is dead and 4 were injured. Also, Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney are still at it. And I think only the most diehard Republicans at this point are paying that close of attention. But I wish them both luck, and I hope that another election year will lead to a more informed and more politically active populace. And now to my favorite part, the science news. There are new studies out suggesting that a more specialized Lego sets, for example, the Harry Potter Lego set instead of like the house Lego set, are damping creativity and collaboration among kids, actually influencing their design skills later in life. They've also observed this when giving adults these Lego play sets compared to just basic Lego blocks. And a quick note, on Wednesday, the 2012 ASM conference on biodefense will be available online streaming. Now, why should you care? Why should you spend your time February 29th to watch this? Well, this is the conference in which the H5N1 engineering of human-to-human transmission will be discussed and that paper being censored. So it definitely affects the science of community and also freedom of speech, which I believe Dominican has a special shindig going for the First Amendment campaign March 12th through 16th. I will have a special report on the Science Freedom of Speech Act in Congress right now that you can go email your legislators desperately to approve during that week, so be sure to tune into Splice then. Also in science news, they have found that brain cells actually control betting behavior in casinos, so your brain knows how you're going to bet before you consciously do. And further, perhaps you can train your brain to actually bet logically. We hope, maybe. They've tried in monkeys, and it didn't really work in their monkey colony. They've also found that ovarian tissue is capable of producing new eggs, which is very thrilling for lots of in vitro treatments and things like that. So instead of having to take young women who will give their eggs to donate or to carry them or to try to use older eggs. You can actually make new eggs from your ovarian tissue. A lot of this is using new understandings of stem cell genetics. And that's all for the news. Real quick, we're going to take a music break to listen to Noah and the Whales, Two Atoms in a Molecule. We will return after that to talk about the theories of physiological love. Stop by, see how scientists fare in the love world and with the physiology of love, and then talk about my 10 favorite interesting animals. So stay tuned. You're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Tritula, and we have more fun yet to come.
Last night I had a dream we were inseparably entwined, like a piece of rope made out of two pieces of vine, held together holding each other with no one else in mind, like two atoms in a molecule inseparably combined. Tragic event, I must admit, but let's not be overblown. I'm not trying to write a love song, it's a sad, pathetic moan. And maybe I just need a change, maybe I just need a new cologne. But now I look at love like being stabbed in the heart. You torture each other from day to day, and then one day you part. Most of the time it's misery, but there's some joy at the start. And for that I'd say it's worth it, just use your blade that's short and sharp on me. If love is just a game, then how come it's no fun? If love is just a game, how come I've never won? I guess maybe it's possible I might be playing it wrong. And that's why every time I roll the dice, I always come undone.
Welcome back. You're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Tritula, and tonight we are discussing the science of love and all its interesting aspects. Yet to come in the show, we have Scientist Meets World, where the scientists go out and play their hand at love and we see how they fare. Then we will talk about the physiology of love. And finally, we'll stop in and check in with my 10 cool animal matings. So, let's talk about scientists and the world. Yes, they actually go outside, kind of like your high school professors or teachers. You'd never imagine. So, Albert Einstein was quoted as saying, "Love is a better teacher than duty." Albert Einstein is also known for marrying his cousin and then leaving her and his child for a nurse. Quite the duty you are leaving behind, Mr. Einstein, for love. And finally, there is Stanley Hall, who is quoted as saying, "Every theory of love from Plato down teaches that each individual loves in the other sex what he lacks in himself." Stanley Hall was a physicist, and as far as I can tell, is still very happily married to his wife of 15 years. So, scientists in the world, mixed bag for love. The physiology of smell has many factors. The physiology of love has many factors, and the most important of which actually is turned out to be smell. And smell of the person you love can also be culturally influenced. So you might love the smell of a hubby, but if you were growing up in India, your hubby could smell completely different and you'd think that's completely intoxicating. On the other hand, they have shown that certain smells to women can actually prevent them from falling in love with another person, despite all the similar characteristics and things like that. Another aspect of love is visual cues. So how attractive do you find a person and how attractive do they find you, as well as muscular, general healthy appearance, and they actually find the look in the eyes is one of the most important aspects of the visual cues. There are auditory cues if you find a person's voice deep and sexy, or high and squeaky, it can substantially change how you feel about another person. And then also there's tactile. So it depends on what a person's skin feels like and things like that. But scientists believe this is actually due to becoming habituated to the way a person feels rather than some sort of inherent like. So you may actually like a construction worker's big calloused hands eventually if you date them for a long time. And you may like a little nerdy scientist's soft, very feminine hands over time. So Helen Fisher is a very important figure in the love science world right now. I believe she just did a series on the History Channel for Valentine's Day, all about the science of love, so be sure to check that out. But I will be looking at some of her research tonight and try to give you a good grasp of what she's getting at. So in your brain, there is a section called the VTA, which produces dopamine. It is actually part of the brain that is believed to be carried over from our reptilian core. So it's believed that snakes have this same brain that we did and just evolved with. It is also the part of the brain that gives you cocaine addiction. The VTA is associated with happy love, and it also is extremely active just after you are dumped. Chances of activating the VTA are improved with deep attachment, and as well as this attachment actually grows and intensifies the brain circuit, so you are actually making yourself more addicted to love all the time. So when you are dumped, your brain actually goes into withdrawal from the same portion that makes cocaine. That's probably why it sucks so much. And their VTA can also be associated with long-term love, which uses similar brain systems, except the brain circuit is a little less activated, but just as strong and seems to be constantly firing. So you're constantly getting this positive reinforcement in long-term love that you're still in love, though you might not be quite so obsessive because the brain circuit just backs off a little, thank God. As we said, romantic love is an addiction. They've actually believed that you can grow tolerant of romantic love. So you can become obsessive with a person for so long that the dopamine that was released when you see them, though the same amount might be there, you don't respond to it the same way. And this can also happen where people do serial relationships where they aren't actually interested in the relationship themselves, or they can't become interested in the relationship because they've grown this tolerance for romantic love. And as we talked about, you can have withdrawal where you go through a lot of the same symptoms, depression, you might actually get ill, it suppresses your immune system when you fall out of love and that circuit isn't activated anymore. And also there's an idea that you can relapse, especially in a weakened state. So if you are just out of relationship, you can relapse into a quickie relationship and put way too much emotion into that rebound relationship than you logically would, because you want to get that high you felt from your long-term loving relationship or your happy obsessive relationship. There are a couple steps in falling in love. As we mentioned before, the VTA, or the ventral tegmental, releases dopamine. This is step one. This section of the brain refines more dopamine, and it is active in young love or puppy love, especially during puberty. It helps create desire, motivation, and stimulation. So you might drive across town for 40 minutes to bring someone flowers, which you might not do for any other reason. But your brain is telling you are so motivated for that person and that relationship because you are so in love that the VTA is going absolutely crazy. So that's step one. You just fall head over heels and you become a crazy cocaine-ish love addict. Step two happens in the nucleus accumbens, which is the portion of your brain that releases oxytocin. This important role in oxytocin actually plays a major part in reproductive life of mammals. This hormone facilitates nest building and pup retrieval in rats. It also facilitates the acceptance of offspring from other species and the formation of adult pair bonds in rodents and prairie voles, which are rodents, but specifically prairie voles. In human, oxytocin stimulates milk ejection. It also stimulates uterine contraction during birth, and it makes you feel very, very pleasant during sex. This second step part of the brain is activated when you are falling deeper in love, and it's the little bugger that tells you to have babies every time you turn around. It is also the little portion of your brain that freaks out when you see a baby on the street. That is your brain giving you oxytocin to tell you to reproduce, as illogical as it might seem in most situations. This is considered the binding molecule that binds you to your mate and your pair. And this portion of the brain doesn't actually seem to develop fully until your mid-20s. And then step three, after you've bound to your mate and you want to reproduce and you've activated that cocaine-ish addiction to motivate you to maintain that relationship, you end up with the caudate nuclei, which helps establish patterns. This is the same region of the brain that you use during driving. So this can actually program you to behave and perform certain tasks in your relationship in sort of a routine, skillful manner. This can be both healthy if you establish good patterns or extremely unhealthy if you establish bad ones. But the point is, when you enter your relationship, you might think you're making a conscious decision to listen to someone or to help the dishes or anything, but you're really just following the patterns, and somehow you end up at the end of the night with your sweetheart and you don't know how you got there. Kind of like driving. There are also three stages of heartbreak. First stage is the protest stage. This is where you try desperately to get the person back. This is where dopamine, especially after a long-term relationship where you might not have used that part of your brain from step one, comes back into play. This is also why you have obsessive exes, because you have so much dopamine being released, focusing on this person, that the brain pathways just go haywire. And literally, they are always on your mind because those pathways will not turn off. The second step is, once you're tired of this, you end up with resignation and despair. You end up having to figure out how to cope with the reality of the situation, and you resign, and finally your logic wins out, though this can be a tiring process. And then finally, if you're unlucky, you have barriers, which you view increase your love, and your brain further gets addicted to the idea of, once the barriers are removed, you can get this person back. Those barriers could be geographical, so you live across other parts of the nations, or it could be personal. So you have this idea that once this person matures, you can get them back forever. And generally, you'll stay in this barrier holding stage until you move on to someone else or get another interest in your life, and those nerve patterns finally calm down. So along with our star, Helen Fisher, there's another scientist well known. That is Dr. Thomas Lewis. He is famous for his work with the limbic system. He finds three different aspects of love. First, there is limbic resonance, which is the wordless and nearly instantaneous emotional attunement that allows us to sense each other's feelings states. Or in normal terms, it's love at first sight, when you look at a person and you are attracted to them. The limbic regulation is the modulation and control of our physiology by our relationships. So how we feel, how motivated we are, how our immune system's doing, things like that. And then finally, we have limbic revision, which is the matter in which relationships alter the very structure of our brain. So over time, depending on what sort of relationship you have, you can actually, as we talked about in our neuroplasticity episode, you can actually grow or shrink portions of your brain. So not only is it bad to watch bad TV, but it is bad to be in bad relationships. You will actually change your brain. So demand more, look for more. Finally, now that we've gotten through how you get in a relationship, how do you keep the romance in this relationship? with science. Well, here's a couple science tidbits about the romantic night. First, as every girl, almost every girl can tell you, chocolate does something magical for us. Well, actually, it's been scientifically proven that chocolate preserves chemicals in the brain which activate positive receptors, including the receptors that are produced and activated with marijuana. So you are almost high on chocolate because you have the same proteins being maintained as if you were taking a low hit of marijuana. There's also the idea that anything novel or rare stimulates dopamine in the brain. So let's say you don't actually go out to fancy expensive restaurants often or get dressed up. This very act in itself of being new stimulates your dopamine and your brain goes, goody, I am engaged. And there's also quite a bit of science to kissing. Kissing actually exchanges testosterone between people through saliva and is absorbed by the cheeks, giving you a good dose of hormones. It's believed this might be why guys like kissing more than females statistically, and guys also like wetter kisses because the guys like to get that dose of testosterone. On that note, there's a difference between male and females in love. Both experience romantic love and changes in hormones when in love. However, men's brains on average are 10% bigger than women's and have 4% more cells. So it's believed that men have a larger storing capacity than women. But women have more brain connections between nerve cells, so women are more likely to make many more connections, and it is believed that's why women are more social, and that's why women can sometimes associate things that men do not. So for example, if you say something like, there's a scuff on your shoe, a woman might freak out and somehow relate it back to her failure to live up to society's standards, and then her mother, and it'll just be a mess. You can blame her 4% smaller, but vastly more connected brain. Females on average as well have deep limbic systems compared to males. That is why they tend to be quote unquote more in touch with their feelings and better to able to express them. The limbic system is the same one that Dr. Thomas Lewis related to love and relationships. And there's also that women are less produce less serotonin than men, meaning women tend to be more prone to depression and are less able to regulate and stabilize their emotions compared to men. Before we move on to our science top 10 cool animal matings, we have Science Where You Least Expect It, our weekly show where we look at science in popular culture. So this week we have love potion number 9. While this isn't true, it's actually believed there are pheromones that do increase romantic and mating behaviors in mammals, including humans. This might be able to explain why Jane suddenly fell for the sexy, very healthy Tarzan who was releasing lots of positive mating hormones since he had never ever mated or been in love. These hormones are believed to fall off after you are in a committed long-term relationship. There's also love at first sight. It's believed that women at different menstruation cycles will actually respond differently to images of men and have different likelihoods of entering a relationship with them. Also, the response time is decreased in women, so they actually jump at things and make more hasty conclusions when on their menstrual cycle than they would normally. And finally, to explain the bad boy attraction, like James Dean, there's the fact that women get to choose. And because they choose, they are more attracted in general by high testosterone masculinity. And this high testosterone level also creates symmetry, height, and parasite resistance, which I guess could have been attractive to the ladies way back when. But it's more showy, it's more classy, and this high testosterone level can actually lead men to have a higher level of fighting inclination, lust inclination, and general passion. So that's why the bad boys are bad, and that's why they look so good to us. Now for my top 10 cool animal matings before we end the show. Number 1, the flatworm. Flatworms are hermaphrodites that And when they mate, they both try to inseminate each other while avoid being inseminated. The individual inseminated becomes the female and has to use the extra resources to make babies. There are also red garter snakes, which mate in a massive ball where a single female excretes a mating pheromone and then many males jump on her, all trying to get close to the right position to mate with her. These balls can be huge and they're actually considered a tourist attraction. There are some males who have adapted to excrete these pheromones, and it is believed that they do so to bring more body warmth and to protect themselves within the ball, though they aren't actually female. Number three is the clownfish. Clownfish can actually change their gender, and this gender determination is done by size. So the largest fish in a clownfish colony is always the female, the second largest is the male, and all others are considered non-mating males. If the largest female dies, the second male will actually become a female and start reproducing. Number four is the garden snail. The garden snail, who would have thought? They actually send out love darts, which are calcium spikes that go into each other's bodies and try to inseminate each other. It was originally thought that these were for nutrition, but science has later revised this to believe it's actually an aggressive attack. Number five is the red velvet mite. This mite actually creates a web of sperm that female follows and it can detect, and they will follow a web they like to mate with a male. However, there are males that go into other people's sperm webs and destroy them, so the female won't follow theirs. Sabotage. There are number six is the fire ant, where queens actually control the sex ratio in their bodies. So most worker ants are actually females and don't like having male ants around because they really only mate with the queen. So when the queen wants to mate, she actually floods the number of male ants within the colony, and the workers, however, cannot manage to kill all the males as they normally would because there's so many of them, and that's how you get more men. There is also the whip lizard, where all females are clones of themselves and they mate in pairs, but each female actually wraps around, mates with herself while in this pair, but you need two to stimulate the mating process. And there is the argonaut, or nautilus, which actually has a detachable sperm which swims to a mating partner after leaving the body of a male to inseminate the female. The anglerfish is a very cool one. There is a tiny male anglerfish born without any digestive system. So as soon as the male fish hatches, they actually swim over to a female who's also just hatched. When the male finds the female, he bites her body and releases an enzyme which digests his skin and her skin, and they fuse together. So there's actually a little male bump constantly in the female anglerfish since birth, and the male wastes away, and this lump just produces sperm when the female is ready to mate. It certainly beats trying to find a mate in the dark. The Argentinian lake duck expels a 17-inch penis, which is the same length as its entire body. It uses this to almost lasso females to mate with them. It is an aggressive mater, and it also has a brush at the very end of the penis to brush away previous suitor's sperm to give his sperm a better chance. And then the runner-up for cool animal matings is the fruit fly. The fruit fly has a 2-inch sperm, which is 1,000 times longer than the human sperm. Its testes make up 11% of its body weight, and the sperm is only long enough to get through the female fruit fly's sperm tract. Let's finish up tonight with thoughts to think. First thought to think, do we have a choice over who we love, or is it all physiological somewhere deep in our subconscious? Do they just smell really good? Second, do we have a choice over what kind of love we have, or is this some sort of psychological, physiological change we have when we are young that determines this? Third, is there a mental limit to love? Do you actually have a limited number of neurons that can submit these dopamines and other chemicals that make you feel in love? And thus, there's only so much you can really love. And finally, do all complex organisms experience love? As mentioned, one of the major components in the mammalian love brain is also part of our reptilian brain. So in clothing, let's quote one of my favorite movies, Greta Garbo in Nunnutschka. Love is a romantic designation for most ordinary biological, or shall we say, chemical process. A lot of nonsense is talked and written about it. Love is a human experience seen in every society. However, I still believe in the magic of love. And I'm not quite sure it can transcend death, but it can sure do a lot. This is Trotula. You have listened for another hour to Splice. Lord help you. I hope you learned something. Next week, we are going to be covering Leap in honor of the Leap Year. Hopefully, I will have a special guest for you. And stay tuned for What's the Tea with Nikki P. and Motastic. You are listening to radio.dominican.edu. Thanks for joining us. And I'm out. See you next week.
B-boys and B-girls, we're in it, do they think? Pump it, louder, come on, don't stop, and keep me going, do it, let's get it on, move it,
come on, baby, do it.
La da dee da da dee da, on the stereo, let the speakers know your mind,
blow my mind, baby,
so let it go.